Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Once dubbed by Interpol as the world's most wanted woman, Lisa Marie Smith faced a possible death sentence when she was arrested and charged with drug smuggling in Thailand in 1996.
When you go to a Thai prison, you face torture, death, disease, and emotional devastation. Welcome to Hell. This is the podcast that tells of the pain Thai prisoners go through and how some of them have escaped. I'm Lisa Tate. I'm a journalist and a chronic podcast creator. This is my third true crime series. Now, we're really lucky today. We have Adrian Simon, who is the author of Milk Blood. He is going to tell us about his experience with a parent being in one of the Bangkok Hilton prisons and how it affected the course of his life. So, Adrian, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And your book, Milk Blood, is amazing, and it followed up your father's book, The Damage Done. He's Warren Fellows. Who is Warren Fellows?
Warren Fellows is my father, but he is notoriously known for being an international heroin trafficker who was caught trying to smuggle 8.5 kilos of smack from Bangkok and spent 12 and a half years in a Thai prison as a consequence.
And he had some colourful friends.
He did. I mean, I don't know if you'd call them friends, but he was also arrested with a famous sports star at the time, Paul Heywood. He was an emerging boxer and a Newtown Jets halfback. Bit of a legend.
You know, he's mentioned in another podcast. Have you heard about the Chris Dawson case, Lynn Dawson?
Yeah, it's been on the news for years and years, on and off.
Yeah, the teacher's pet. Now, It's up for appeal and he denies it, Chris Dawson, but there were allegations that someone tried to go via Chris Heywood to get someone to knock Lynn Dawson off.
Right, okay.
So this is the kind of atmosphere these guys were in, that kind of rugby league fraternity, and we're talking like 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't really know. But given that time period and the people that were circulating in that part of Sydney,
way I read it from your dad's book and your book is, though, the boss was Arthur Neddy Smith, a notorious Australian killer. Hmm. But you don't really say no to him once you get involved.
Well, yeah. It's hard for me to sort of comment on, you know, the dealings of my father and Neddy because I wasn't privy around. And yeah, I've sort of learnt to remove myself from those sort of even thoughts when I was growing up. Was quite obviously very messy, and he's a very dangerous, or was a very dangerous character. Yeah, it's pretty shady.
Yeah, well, you started life living in a penthouse apartment with views of Manly Beach and Sydney Harbour.
Beautiful.
Yes, until you were 2 years old when your dad got arrested, and they took your mum aside and detained her briefly as well.
Yeah, it was guilt by association, really, until proven innocent. Yeah, it was a long – that was probably the – well, being so young, I can't remember her court case, but being removed from my mother when my father was in a you know, in another country being arrested was very traumatic for me as a young boy. Plus, her parents, you know, that just set everything off. Yeah, it was international news alone, my father being caught in Thailand.
Mm.
They were making a massive deal out of it.
It's still a massive deal today, isn't it?
It is. I can't tell you how many people I've met travelling in here and abroad that know of my father's story, the damage done, and now parts of mine and the story at large. There's a lot of interest in prisons and drugs and crime, and it's nice for me to be able to tell sort of an extension to that.
Yeah, well, a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because you had a difficult childhood as well, and you didn't see grandmother on one side from the age of six, isn't that right?
That's about right, yeah.
And is that because things were just so complicated?
People are complicated, aren't they?
Mm.
Yes, terribly complicated. You know, having a father in a Thai prison, my mum having to support him while looking after me and dealing with the heat back here. She got blamed for a lot of things she wasn't directly connected with. I guess, sadly, my father's mother sort of took a sort of scapegoat option and just pushed us aside.
Because it was hard to deal with.
Yeah.
But your mum took you to see him in prison. Now, this prison is not the one Lisa Marie Smith was in. It's actually another one in Bangkok, and it's known as the Big Tiger.
Yeah.
And it's Bang Quang?
Bang Quang, yeah. Yep. He went to a few. I always get them muddled up in the top of my mind, but some Chiang Mai and the prison cells in Bangkok. But, yeah, Bangkok Hilton and Big Tiger. It supposedly lashes your soul and steals your life.
So that was where you went with your mum to that jail in Bangkok.
Yeah.
You had to wait. It was hot. It was humid. You were four.
Yep.
And your mum had to pay off some guards.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, on the outside, Thailand's quite a beautiful place. On the inside of a Thai prison, it's exactly the opposite. It's bloody horrible. It's hot and run down and a lot of barbed wire and steel doors, like you can imagine. But, yeah, so mum had to sort of pay her way for us to get in, and it was possibly the last time, well, it actually was going to be the last time that my father could see me and vice versa, because he was to be executed.
Yes, that's right. Like David McMillan, he was featured on this podcast as well. He was going to be executed and he had 2 weeks' notice.
Right.
Yeah, so your dad wasn't allowed to touch you.
No, we were separated by bars, yeah. We tried. My mum told me, you know, I've got vague memories of things, but like just snapshot images, but, you know, arms were stretched out and he was abusing the guard and, you know, I was screaming and crying and it was a horrible moment. There's nothing nice about it.
It's dreadful.
Yeah.
And then when you found out what your dad was in jail for when you were nine.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I kind of was, I knew, you know how kids know certain things and, you know, when I was young, when it went down, I was obviously aware that something bad had really happened. Father was gone. People were acting strange. My mum was always overseas or working and away a bit. And probably when I was about nine-ish, was sitting around at my grandfather's house that we'd moved into just for my stability. And on comes an ABC kind of news program, and there's my father behind prison bars. And the room just went ice cold. Like, I knew I could just tell the interaction between my mother and her father, who was a very strict English man, smart guy, hated everything that was going on. Ice in a room, and I just knew then, penny dropped, you know, just even though they didn't say a word, I figured it out.
That's such old school Australian though, never spoken of again.
Well,
let's put it under the carpet, you know.
Well, they spoke at length later, like, you know, they both left the room and it was not nice, like, you know, it was a case of this is never ending. And the next morning my mother told me, before I was about to go to school, she just said, well, that was your father and he's in a foreign country. He did a very bad thing and sadly he's not coming home.
And then after that, it was significant for you because you were having really terrible anxiety attacks.
Well, that triggered them, really. I was showing pre-mental health problems, probably, they call it obsessive thought disorder.
Yep.
And I was on the cusp of, and I was just showing probably, I was too interested in achieving with sport. You know, I was sort of lashing out in class. You know, I look back and go, it's obvious why. But when seeing him on television and that proverbial penny dropping, my mind sort of imploded into a repetitive thought cycle, and I couldn't get what turned out to be quite violent images into my mind, out of my mind, and it sort of became obsessive and it was scary, and I had a breakdown. And the breakdown lasted about 2 years.
My gosh, so all those years of your childhood lost, really?
Yeah, it was interesting because when I was writing Milk Blood and I was going back over my childhood, and you know, I said to my mum, I said, oh, I had a great childhood. And she's like, well, you did, but you know, there was times there that were pretty awful for you. And her, like as in having to deal with having me like that. But thankfully I found a way through sort of cognitive behavioural therapy with a child psychologist, meditational stuff. Yep.
And they said something really key to you that, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's okay to have that thought, it'll go.
In a way, yeah. It's paradoxical. They want you to face those images and what creates the anxiety in the mind. And so, yeah, instead of running from it, you run towards it.
Yeah. No, it is really interesting. And then your dad comes home. That's obviously a whole unsettled a few things. And he wasn't able to see you until, were you 18 or was it 16?
By law, 16.
Yep.
But it was up to me. The judge ruled that he would be deemed unsafe to see me, given his time in the Thai prison and the drug abuse and, you know, the effects, the lagging effects and possibly how he would be.
That's right, because your mother heard that he was still getting heroin in the Thai jail.
Yeah, he was a full-blown heroin addict.
I think you can get anything on there, like in a Thai prison.
Oh, everything.
You could. You could just say, oh, I'd like a dinosaur, and someone would find one somehow.
That airlifted T-Rex in.
Well, David McMillan was saying earlier, he was able to, like, look after himself okay there because he had some money. So it doesn't, like, shock me that there were drugs there.
Oh, the place is riddled with it. I mean, that's how the prisoners survived. I mean, I think... Yeah, my father later in life told me, he goes, the first thing I noticed was just how everyone was just completely out of it. I mean, and a lot of it were, apart from what we'd see as street drugs here being, you know, smack and sort of those kind of drugs, but, you know, it was all pharmaceutical drugs and leftovers from the Vietnam War. So you're getting heavy duty sort of knockout stuff.
Oh.
Anything they can mix together.
Okay, so they weren't getting any Hitler's leftover meth or anything.
Probably.
Kennedy was on that, so possibly.
I think my father would have had anything.
This is not a drug podcast, by the way.
We're not condoning drugs, say no.
Just say no, that's right. You'll end up in the Bangkok Hilton. Yeah. So when did you first see your dad? How old were you then?
I was 16. It's bizarre. I couldn't believe it. When I was telling a friend about it years ago, we were just talking about when I did meet him. It was at a place called the Courthouse Hotel in Oxford Street, Sydney.
And oh, I know that one.
Yeah, it's pretty seedy.
Yeah.
It's open all night. But inside the Courthouse Hotel, there's what they call the Judgment Bar. And so the irony, just how it all unfolded, you couldn't make it up. And anyway, so yeah, Mum took me in to see him and sort of readied myself, and it was a nice sunny day, and we walked in and he was sitting there by himself watching horse races. And it was funny because I saw him and I thought, instant relaxation, because I was taller than him. You know, I thought, okay. So that biological assessment.
Yep.
I won my first little battle being a bit taller. And I told him that straight away.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he contacted me probably 3 or 4 months prior to that. He wasn't allowed to because I hadn't turned 16 yet. He called the house phone, and I answered it, and I knew straight away that this was something different. And
did he sound like you on the phone or anything?
Oh, no, I can't really tell. I mean, he just had a really raspy voice, like he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and just was trying to pull the words together asking me sort of random questions that were a bit odd. And I just put the phone down and rang out the back and said, I think there's this dude on the phone, he's calling himself Warren. And Mum's like, oh, shit.
I wasn't prepared for that today.
No, no one was, you know. I think she was having a cigarette pretty soon after that as well.
Yeah, I imagine she would have, because it's so much on her.
Yeah.
It's not easy being a parent. It's so hard. And just with all these other circumstances thrown in, she had obviously was married to the guy.
Yeah.
Had her whole life changed and, you know, had to live with her parents for a while.
Yeah, she chose to do that for me, to have stability and security in schools and things.
And, yes, we need to talk about your mum.
Yeah.
She nearly got eaten by a tiger.
I know. Her life is... it's out there.
And it's inspired your book, your second book, was it?
Unbreaking the Girl.
Unbreaking the Girl. It's based on her life.
It is. It's it's based on her travels before she even met Warren. So she had a very sort of traumatic childhood herself. And she left Australia when she was 16 and found a way all through Asia into India. And had a pretty exotic life.
Oh, she was chased by cannibals.
Yeah, that's right, in Sumatra.
I forgot that bit. That's probably more unusual than the tiger.
Yeah, little heads wrapped around their necks.
This is all true, people, I tell you.
It is.
Okay, so you met him that day at the judgment bar.
Mm.
And what was it like? Was it uncomfortable, awkward?
It was, yeah. I mean, it was strange. It was actually harder for... my parents together.
Mm.
You know, I kind of stepped into a senior role, per se. I don't know how that works, but a psychologist once told me that kids do that when there's traumatic breakdowns with families and parents. But, yeah, it was weird. I was watching my mum and dad. That's how I looked at it. I was going, my mum and dad, I've never called him dad. And I was like, oh, this is strange. It was bizarre.
I've got them both in the same room.
Yeah, and they were acting the role.
Were they?
Oh, it was clear, yeah.
Mm.
Warren, not so much. He was a mess. Like, he was tapping his toe relentlessly under the table and was, you know, deeply affected. Like, I was surprised. I thought he wouldn't live very long by the looks of him.
Mm.
Yeah, he was pretty messed up.
Yeah.
He was keeping it together, but he was clearly affected.
And then one night he rings and said he's bringing out a book. Is that right? Is that how it happened?
Yeah, well, we went to visit him. He just randomly drops it and says, well, yeah, I'm going to write a book. And he loved himself. He loved himself so much. He's like, it's going to be the best thing in the world. It's a big seller. You know, he's right into it. And Mum and I just looked at each other and we're like, oh, God, no, please. Because, you know, my identity had remained pretty much secret.
Mm.
My mum and family had hidden me from the heat of pretty nasty potential backlashes from him being in prison.
But also... you changed your surname.
Yeah, when I was 7.
Mm.
So that's just, I think, yeah, primary school was, okay, it's time to change your name because people will recognise the fellow's, it'll follow you, the fellow's surname. And so I was born Adrian Simon Fellows on my birth certificate and my mother's father's surname is Simon. So I extended it and, you know, my mum said, oh, you want to give yourself a middle name? And I was like, do people have middle names? And I didn't realise at that age. James Bond was my favourite movie character and I went, well, it's going to be James. So it changed to Adrian James Simon.
Well, that's not bad, is it?
Three first names.
As your whole name.
Yeah,
that's quite unusual.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, like, it's different.
It is.
Yeah.
And the James Bond inspiration's quite good.
Yeah, I still love James Bond.
You got to love James Bond. So he's writing this book. And you're saying, please don't.
Well, we didn't say it like that. I didn't object to it.
Yep.
To him that day because it was a bit of a shock. I was like, I guess, you know, I wasn't interested in media or the focus of that. I didn't really know what that entailed directly when he first mentioned it because I was keen on playing sports for Australia and that was a healthy sort of focus. And when we drove home from his apartment, Mum's like, God, this is... You know, she was freaking out because, you know, what we didn't know what he could possibly make up or say or where his head would be or what, you know, the publishers might want out of it, as in what type of story they want to tell. And
because mentally he wasn't great either, was he, at the time?
No, I wouldn't. No, there's no way. You know, came out a drug addict, years of abuse and torture inside the Thai prison in conjunction with drug abuse, post-traumatic stress without a question, and he had HIV and Hep C and God knows what else at the time, and that's not a good recipe for health.
No, it's not. It certainly isn't. But I suppose he thought, well, as you said, he was pretty confident that he had it all under control. He probably said he needed the money, you know?
Oh, definitely, yeah. That's his number one goal in life was money. That's what got him in trouble in the first place. Yeah, he wasn't just an innocent kid who thought he was just going to do this one-time thing and, you know, he was all about cash, fast money. You know, he grew up trackside, so he was a gambler and he was an SB bookmaker.
So and it's interesting that you say when you walked into the judgment bar, he was watching the races.
Oh, yeah, he was putting – he won too that day.
Was he distracted by them when you were talking?
Not really. I mean, yes and no. He like all punters, they know when their race is on, so they kind of shut up for 30 seconds or a minute, however long the race is. And yeah.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So how long until the impact was felt by his book?
Pretty immediate when it came out. Yeah, that changed everything for us.
Did it?
It was like, well, because Mum told him, you know, to leave us out of it. And he respected that. So we were spared from being publicised ourselves, thankfully. Because I wouldn't have handled it at the time, and Mum couldn't either. Like, we'd done our best just to move on, and just because it kept following us, you know. When I mean following us, it's the emotional follow-on. You know, things don't stop.
No.
The media does for a time, and then
comes
it re-emerges
again.
And, you know, people dive into these lives just for in and out when they have an opportunity. But for us as a family, it was, you know, it's a lifelong thing, and having him tell his story with the way it is, it catapulted him into some kind of celebrity status.
I remember that stage in Sydney. Roger Rogerson was around and he used to have drinks with across from the Fairfax building at the pub there quite a lot. He became a bit of a... And then there was Chopper Reid.
Yeah.
There was this kind of humanising of criminals in the Australian media. So I can totally see what you're saying.
It's a bizarre thing, I mean, because when you're on the other side of it and you understand what that world can provide, as in the consequences of all these actions, you know, it's nothing what you see in the media or on the TV or on the news or anything.
It's not glamorous.
It's crazy. It's full on. They're not normal people.
Well, when I was talking to David, he just said it's a miserable life.
But yeah, I can imagine. It's everything's glamorised, isn't it, for, you know... It's a fantasy kind of projection
underbelly
of things. Sadly so, yeah. I mean, Australia was founded on convicts or, you know, the white settlement of Australia and having Ned Kelly and those kind of characters sort of immortalised as folklore, sort of, that backbone of that rebellious, roguish kind of criminal sort of became popular.
It is popular.
Yeah. Where Warren, he was a different character. He was a very smooth, sharp-talking, good-looking person who knew how to talk a big game.
So he was charming everyone.
He was an A-class narcissist.
Was he?
Yeah. Yeah, he loved himself.
So he thought his book was great.
Oh, yeah.
And it was ghostwritten, though.
Yes, yep.
So he thought it was the bee's knees.
He thought he was the bee's knees.
So, okay, so the book comes out, he thinks he's the bee's knees, he's getting all this attention.
Yeah.
So it ricocheted onto you guys, though, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm the type of person who I take things in quite deeply.
Yeah.
And I think that happened from word go. And so I have a huge amount of energy to expend, and so I expended it. I got quite, not just pushing everything I had into sports, but if I was out and, you know, I got into a lot of fights, cutting it down.
Yeah, and then you went overseas because you were like, I've had enough.
And yeah, I took too many hits to the head.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You did. Yeah. Your mum must have been so worried about you for a while.
She brings it up every now and then. It's like,
does she?
Yeah, it's the worst.
But you went and had like an adventure now with your grandfather's brothers on your mum's side.
Yeah.
And was it the Isle of Wight where you were going around?
It was the Channel Islands and Alderney, and then my grandfather's other brother, he had seven or nine brothers actually, but he was in France, and he kind of opened my whole world to the possibilities of everything.
He was in Toulouse, wasn't he?
Not far from there, yeah.
Because I think you wanted to make your own way, didn't you, and not be guarded by that story. Although, did you ever hear of it come up in the UK, or did anyone recognise you as the son of Warren?
They didn't recognise me, but so I went to play cricket. That was my break to get to the UK, and I was 21, and about a week or two later I flew to the UK, cricket bag, had people looking after me. Thankfully, my first place that I stayed was a guy the same age and best mates now, but within a few days he came home from work and, you know, I was just chilling, and comes in with a FHM magazine, which was a very popular magazine back in the day in the UK, and he's like, oh man, it was blokes at work are talking about this story, this guy in a Thai prison, you know, it's like full on, and I was sort of brushing it off, and then he just like shoved it on in front of me, and I was like, God,
that's my dad.
You're not going to believe this. And he goes, I just had to have a good look at the picture. And he's like, no way, man, you can't be serious. I mean, he couldn't believe me straight up. And then
there is a resemblance, though.
When he was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the lifestyle knocked his looks away. But, yeah, so it did follow me in that sense.
How long did it take you to convince your mate?
About the length of one joint.
Lucky you're in the UK. We don't want you getting arrested.
Yeah, no, we don't. We say no to drugs.
Although, the ironic thing is now, Thailand has decriminalised for personal use marijuana.
Oh, is it? Isn't that interesting?
After destroying lots of lives. I don't think I'll be able to, like, go back there for a while, even though I'm using my maiden name.
Right.
I don't want to get, like, thrown in myself for being a journalist. They like to lock journalists up.
Do they? I don't know. I was pretty apprehensive to go there myself.
Because you thought you'd be on a list.
Well, yeah, we used to get searched quite a bit going travelling, yeah.
So you're having this great time in the UK, but when did you decide to write the book? Was that while you were living there, or did you come back home?
No, it was a long time after that. I always had it in my mind that something I might do.
Yeah.
There were stories to tell, but they weren't formed. I was far from understanding myself, and I was living a pretty decent life travelling, getting away from the past. It took me probably my mid-30s. I had a media career for a while and understood more about how to pull stories together. Basically, I didn't really have much of an idea, but I started off wanting to make a film out of my father's book, which sort of bonded us back together after being estranged for a long time. I know we've jumped time period there, but that's how it sort of started for me to then thinking about my own story.
So how long were you estranged?
Best part of, well, on and off, like he came in and out in sort of weird and random ways, but, you know, I left when I was 21. I travelled for the best part of 10 years, and you know, came back and forth quite a bit, but he wasn't around. So mate, I would have saw him probably 4 or 5 times in that in 10 years, and then something happened, and I decided that I'd never wanted to see him again. He just, I don't know, really upset me, and that was it for me.
Yep.
And I was overseas, and I remember the moment I was like, well, you know, I can't ever, I've got to get rid of him.
Because you realise.
Yeah, his life drags me down.
Yep. I can totally understand that.
It's, yeah.
You kind of get that.
Yeah, but I took him back later in life.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, but that's when he came back into my life, when he just contacted me through this really random person.
Yep.
Who also was a knockabout crook. And he wanted to see me, and he just called me one day, and I picked up the phone, and I probably was early 30s, and I shouldn't have answered, but I did, and, yeah, I caught up with him again, and he didn't look too well. He was very sick, sort of out of it, and then my mum told me, he goes, oh, how do you look? And then she explained that, yeah, he was clearly medicated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was he really unwell then too?
Yeah.
You thought...
Well, we all thought he wouldn't live long coming out of prison because...
No, it's quite remarkable, really, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
With HIV then, yeah, people sort of don't really think about it too much these days, but I think that was partly why he was released from prison.
Mm.
And, he, you know, having HIV and AIDS was a death sentence then.
Yeah, it was.
So we didn't really think he'd live too long.
But he did. So yeah. We're talking now, like, you're mid-30s when you saw him after coming back, or 30, 31?
Yeah, I was about that age, and that's when he reconnected me after that 10 years sort of apart. And he did, as I said, he didn't look well, and there was that ethical family question within myself.
Mm.
Is this the time to make amends and try to sort of heal a pretty or beyond broken sort of relationship? And he expressed an interest to do so. So there were moments where he was genuine in wanting to have a son in his life.
That's interesting for a narcissist.
Well, there was things to gain for him.
Mm.
Yeah. It sucks for me to be able to say that. Like, he wasn't a totally bad person. You know, there is goodness in him. But, you know, before prison, he was quite a shallow man.
Yeah.
And he was gifted in himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was nice sides to him. Like, he genuinely... You know, my parents lived in India, and he'd pay for kids to, you know, shave their heads and give them money. And
yep.
So there was a caring and giving side to him. But when it came to his core personality, it was about him.
Mm.
But going through prison and coming out of prison, I think that just amplified it.
Yes.
Intensely. Because when you're in there, in a place like that, you don't have anything. And what you do have, you hold on for dear life. And so he and with all the drugs and the horrific stuff he saw, and I'm not making excuses for him, but
no.
I think it really reshaped his brain chemistry.
Yes, it would have. Yeah.
So, yeah, he was a very damaged individual.
So when did you decide to write your book then?
Well, I shot off overseas after spending some time with him, because I was living in the UK and I had connections from working at Sky News, and I thought, well, I'll take his book. And as a father and son, we'll make a movie together out of his story, and that will be our way to heal. And I went overseas and spent nearly a year just couch surfing and doing whatever I can to get this thing moving, and met different people in the industry. And wasn't long into my time that, you know, industry leaders, filmmakers, were saying, kind of, we want to know about you and your mum, and want to thicken up the story. Mm. So is there more to this? You know, your father's book, huge numbers sold and many people know it, but what else have we got to work with? And so connected with a couple of producers, and one thing led to another where I was asked to sort of fill in some gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started talking to my mum, and she started divulging in things, and one thing led to another. I put pen to paper and wrote Milk Blood when I was about 35. So it came out a few years later.
It is an amazing book. I just think because it opens your eyes to what you may not think about, you know, because there's like the whole media focus, but you have to live that your whole life. And I just find it's an incredible account. It's chronological, but I like also how the hero of the story is not him, it's your mother.
Well, she was the hero. Yeah, yep. She kept it together.
Absolutely.
Don't know how, but she did. The strength of her is remarkable.
Mm. Strength of character.
Yeah. Her father would always impress on us, because they were from that war generation. Mm. You know, it was internal fortitude, and they had a very different way of projecting their own personality. Never complain.
Never explain.
Never explain. That's right. You know, carry on.
Exactly, yeah. I don't think there'll be another generation quite like them.
No. I still like to hold quite a lot of the values that I was imparted with.
Yeah.
From that.
Absolutely. Obviously, you had for a while it percolating in your head, a book. And how long did it take you?
From start to finish, probably the first draft, maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
Like intensely wrote nearly every day for about 8 months.
Yep.
And it was about 130,000 words, which I'm writing a couple of short stories at the moment. I'm like 20,000 words. I'm going, how on earth did I do 130,000 words?
I was
words?
Just thinking that this podcast is 12,000 words yeah. so far. So right. That's a lot of writing, 130,000.
It is, but it got trimmed back, and then publishers get involved and editors come in and, you know, they tidy everything up. And, you know, because that was the first time project for me. I didn't excel at school with English, but I learnt through media the type of how to contain what I thought would be the right story to tell commercially. So I learned a lot putting that book together. But yeah, from start to finish, you know, getting contracts and publishing deals and finished product takes about two years, I'd say.
And I suppose the reaction you got from your family was different to the people who've read the book, like, you know, your average reader.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's harder for me to ask. Like, if they come out and tell me what their thoughts are, that's great. And I've actually learnt a lot about my friends from them reading my story as well. They've felt they could open up and say a few different things about their pasts and what's been quite relatable in my story to theirs. And I also get that with strangers that contact me.
Yeah.
You know, I randomly just get messages from people, and I love it actually, because people are quite thoughtful in their approach, and they introduce themselves and then they say, well, this part, you know, I'm a teacher, or, you know, I did this or travelled here, and, you know, whatever it is. And it's really nice to humanly connect on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. But you also had someone who thought you were related contact you.
Oh, recently. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Sadly, it didn't work out. I was quite, I don't know how to take it at first. It was just approached, and but we did the DNA test, and it wasn't.
Poor guy. You have to feel for him when he thinks that he's finally got a connection, and then no.
Yeah, it's sad. I'll give it to him though. I learned a few things from his strength, because I had to put myself in his shoes. He was adopted at birth, and then into sort of a religious church, I guess, for the first 6 years, and then into a family. And he didn't know his father at all, and only met his mother like a decade or.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
To a go. So, you know, having to have all those questions answered, I wish I could have, we got a positive result, being cousins, but we weren't.
You weren't. Well,
but he was strong. Like, he was prepared for it.
I think it's true. Everyone has a story. And if you want to know more about Adrian's story or what happened with his dad, you'll have to buy the book. Will we leave it on a cliffhanger, shall we?
Well, there's always more. I mean,
exactly. And we're very lucky. Adrian has donated two books, Milk Blood and his father's book, The Damage Done, which I can give away. So go to escapingbangkok.com and I'll put a link in the show notes. But everyone does have a story, and thank you for sharing yours.
Hey, you're welcome. It's always fun to impart some of this past. Like I was just thinking to myself yesterday on final note that I'm 45 now, and I actually, it's quite surreal now. I look back and go, did that all happen? Because I feel I'm a completely different person now.
Yeah, you do, don't you, yeah. As you get older?
That's right. You realise at different ages, you go, well, okay, you got to live with that, and what else now?
Exactly. You just, and I think it's easier to sort of gloss over time.
Yeah, time has different meanings. Like, I guess when you hit your middle age, like I am, you kind of go, well, okay, better figure out what I want to do now for the rest of it.
Exactly, yeah.
To be happy and healthy.
Exactly. But thank you, Adrian. We so appreciate you sharing your story.
No, thank you.
And I'll put all your social links in the show notes as well. So if people want to have a look, check you out on Facebook, or that would be great.
Yep. Come over and
excellent.
Check
well,
it out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was recorded on Warramai land. We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this program was produced. We pay our respects to all First Nations people and acknowledge elders past and present. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to come back next week. Until then, this is Lisa Tate, and don't forget to ask yourself, could you survive a Thai prison?
This is the Escaping Bangkok Podcast. If you're hungry for more, follow us, Escaping Bangkok Podcast, on TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or visit escapingbangkok.com.